Hello, welcome to the CityWire Funds Fanatic podcast. My name is Gavin Lumsden, and with me is my colleague Daniel Grote, editor of CityWire Funds Insider website. Every week we get together and have a chat about funds and investment trusts. Changed to this week's format, though, for the first time, we've got our guest. We have David Stevenson, who writes a weekly column for both the Investment Trust Insider and Funds Insider websites. So many of you will know of him. He's a leading investment commentator, written for the Financial Times for many years, and also nowadays an investment trust director as well. David, thanks very much for joining us. It's good to see and hear from you.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Okay, no problem. Now, you write the Adventurous Investor daily blog. People can find that at adventurousinvestor.com. I think that suggests that your interest in a wide range of investment opportunities and asset classes. You're well known for covering alternative assets. Not necessarily always your enthusiasm for stock markets, particularly in present conditions. But we're going to have a chat to you about your thoughts and your activities, but I'm going to pass over to Dan now, who's going to ask you a few questions.
Great. Thanks, Gavin. Hi, David.
Hi, Dan. How are you? You well?
Not bad. Yeah, not bad. Yeah, I just wanted to delve straight in, really, and get your view on where markets are. I mean, you've written about it in your columns on our website, and your last column gave a pretty good pricey in that, you know, like many investors, you're not gung-ho about markets, neither do you feel that, you know, the end is nigh.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we're about to go to hell in a handcart, although, you know, our economy may be about to. But and equally, as you said, I'm not particularly enthusiastic, and I'm quite high cash, so I'm probably net effective about 50% cash. And some of the rest of that is also in stuff that either I can't sell because I'm a director, or it's kind of in hedge funds or that kind of stuff. So I am a bit cautious. The reality of it is that most of the gains in the market have been, until recently, have been really kind of chalked up by big mega cap US tech names, or certainly the tech sector. When the first big sell-off happened around the middle of February, I switched quite aggressively into a whole bunch of kind of tech-orientated stuff, including Scottish Mortgage, which, you know, James Anderson's fund, which is very tech-orientated. And I sort of rode that really all the way through till, gosh, when was that? Probably about the end of April now. And then I just looked at the valuations. It's crazy, you know. I mean, I'm not the only one who's noticed it. Virtually everybody on the planet's noticed it. Some of the valuations are just bonkers, you know. We're sort of back to 1999, 2000, really. And we've had a bit more of a kind of widespread rally in the last couple of weeks. And there's even been talk about kind of value stocks coming back. And I've certainly always run a kind of side pocket of what I call bounce back stocks, chief amongst them things like Carnival, EasyJet, that kind of stuff. And I watched them and occasionally bought them, and they've bounced back quite aggressively in June. But even they've gone a little bit kind of off the boil in the last couple of weeks. So it's an odd old market. And I'm not going to add anything more than anybody else has said, which is I don't really understand how you can have such an expensive market when the economy is tanking, and it's likely to go even further down because we've not got to the edge of the furlough cliff yet in both the UK and the US. With all sorts of other things that I'm not going to bother, you know, making obvious going on around us. I don't really quite understand it myself. I wanted to write a column which said, you know, how to invest for people who don't like investing at the moment. That's probably the way I put it.
Yeah. It's interesting that you made that switch into, and you mentioned Scottish Mortgage, that switch into as early as February. I mean, you know, we've seen since that tech has emerged as this, you know, bizarre defensive asset in the corona crisis. Was that, did you have a mind towards that when you were moving into that sort of sector? Or?
Yeah, no, I'm not going to claim any great prescience, but I just thought that, you know, frankly, you know, if the world was going to head in a handcart, and what people were going to carry on spending their money on was they're probably going to spend their money on tech, weren't they? And therefore, that was probably not a bad place to hang out, really. And you know, the likes of the Googles and the Facebooks of the world, they're bound to see, you know, massively increased traffic. I'm sure CityWire has seen massively increased traffic over the last 2 or 3 months, as, you know, as more and more people, frankly, have a lot of more time on their hands and work from home or work from home with inverted commas. So I know they don't claim any great prescience. I just thought it might be a more sensible place to hang out. And also, I think, you know, when you're in a sell-off, what you want to do is you want to go into stuff that's frankly the most profitable with the widest competitive moat against, you know, against kind of margin erosion. And, you know, tech stocks do tick that box. The problem is though, that, I mean, prices have come bonkers. You know, I mean, Tesla's a classic example. And, you know, James Anderson is a great fan of Tesla. And, you know, I don't really have a great view on Tesla. You know, that's what I outsourced to James Anderson for, Scottish Mortgage, to have a view on that. But even I think that Tesla's a bit bonkers priced, yeah. You know, I mean, I just don't quite understand how, you know, Matt Levine, who's a fantastic columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, did a great piece which to just say basically Tesla is the sum of all our hopes about the future. And it doesn't really bear much relationship back to practical valuations. And, you know, maybe that is what will happen. But, you know, history teaches us that eventually mean reversion kicks in and things find their true value. And that's probably what I think. Tech stocks were likely to do well. They did well. They've probably overdone it and they're probably a bit overpriced.
I guess the issue with buying stuff and making changes to your portfolio when stock markets are going through the extreme sort of bouts of volatility that we saw earlier this year is where you're getting the money from, you know, whether you're selling stuff that has fallen to buy other stuff that you think is going to do slightly better. But I guess in your case, it was you had that big cash position and that's what you started deploying in February?
Yeah, I was already, I think even in the end of January, I was about 30% cash because I've always been a bit cagey. I've thought that markets were a bit high anyway. I wanted to invest more money in the UK domestic equity market, which at the time, and probably still is the case, is undervalued. And I thought had better prospects than everybody else thought, particularly because most international investors are on a downer about the UK because of Brexit. And, you know, I'm not going to make any views about Brexit, but I felt that was a disproportionate reaction. Unfortunately, you know, you can now mount an argument for saying that the UK is probably going to also lag behind for the next 6 to 12 months because we have an unholy collection of stocks in things like, you know, resources companies, which haven't been doing terrifically well. And you know, you can make an argument for saying that the damage caused by the excess deaths in the UK has had an impact on the UK domestic economy. And I know some economists certainly on the left make that argument. So I think, unfortunately, the bit of the bear argument against UK equities has been reinstated. But going back to what I was saying earlier on, I was about 30% in cash anyway. And then basically when the first kind of big bout came, I just literally just took a list down my list of ISA and SIP shareholdings and just said, because I actually still have a broker that I ring up. I mean, I know that's scary. I just sell everything, you know, I can sell. And I think it was about a week, and it was about a week after really markets began to really tank. So that probably be middle end of February. And in case you ask me why do I have a broker that I actually ring up and speak to as opposed to do online, I've actually found it quite a good discipline because he charges an arm and a leg. Yeah, he charges me a load of money. I therefore don't ring him up very often because I'm too stingy. Yeah. My turnover in my portfolio is extremely low normally because if I have to do it, it's going to cost me an arm and a leg, so I don't bother doing it. So it's a good discipline to have. And of course, it falls over when you have to do a lot of trading. But it's also well worth it because you can bounce ideas off people. You can say, you know, am I the only one who's buying Scottish Mortgage at the moment? This will be end of February. And you can go, no, David, actually quite a lot of other people are. And that's quite a helpful thing to do, actually. So it's not, you know, although I'm a great believer in keeping prices low, keeping fees down, actually sometimes spending a bit more money on getting the service is quite a good idea. But anyway, so just going back to answer your question directly. Yeah. So I went from about 30% cash to about 70% cash, then went back into the market quite aggressively.
Yeah. And Scottish Mortgage has obviously turned out to be a very good buy. I mean, generally, do you think you had a good coronavirus crisis in investment wise?
Well, I hesitate to say good. Not bad. I mean, look, I look back. I remember doing a little. I got my notebook, and it's a good exercise for everybody to do. And I did a kind of what did I feel my portfolio would go down to? So what do I think my maximum drawdown would be? And I think I penciled in rather ambitiously, I must say. I penciled in a kind of 45% peak to trough decline. And then I might just bounce back to, say, down 35-25%. I felt that I'd do all right if I'd done that. You know, it's the same kind of thing. You know, we'd have a good coronavirus if only 20,000 people died. And actually, I just looked at my portfolios now, and I've gone back to cash, by the way, to answer one of your up and coming questions. I'm pretty much there where I was at the end, at the beginning of February, sort of roughly a minus. I think on my SIP, I'm minus 3%. On my one of my ISAs, I'm minus 4%. So that's not bad, you know. I'm not claiming any great prescience. I'm fairly happy with it because I thought I'd be looking at a minus 45%, minus 35%, minus 30%, you know. And if I'm honest with myself, I still think markets should be 20% lower.
I mean, I found that in the teeth of the crisis, it got to a point where I just stopped looking at my portfolio. It was making me panic, and it was making me react to my investments in exactly the way that you're told that you shouldn't. And I think it was really about a week of that before bottom, and then we started recovering, and then I felt emboldened enough to actually have a look. I didn't do anything, but I had a look at what was going on, because it just got quite scary. I just wonder where you sort of sit now, because you talk about sort of where you see markets going, and that there is really still scope for a fall. I was looking back at what you'd written in April around the waves of the virus, and not the waves of the virus itself, but the waves of its impact and its economic impact and its impact on stock markets. So you were talking about the first immediate reaction, which obviously we had when stock markets fell. The second reaction, which was really when there would be this realization that the virus would peak and it would then fall, and there would be a bounce back in stock markets. So the third, where you have this after effect, where the fallout, the economic fallout, really starts to tell, and that's the point where you were talking about, you know, maybe a 10 to 25% fall in stock markets. I mean, it certainly seems that we're there in terms of the economic impact, but we're certainly not there in terms of the stock market impact.
Yeah, no, I personally think we're still early in the crisis. I mean, you know, I think that the bit I worry about is that, and I did worry about it. I remember sitting there, like all of us did, you know, consuming much too much news information and news flow. And, you know, I found, I think I wrote about it at one point, I actually had to go and take a meditation app just to calm me down, because I ended up staring at too many bloody news flows. Because it was, and it's terrible for journalists, particularly because it's our job, you know. My missus would say, oh, darling, why don't you just ignore it all? And it's like, well, I can't, it's my job, actually. I think we're only just at the beginning of both the next waves. The first wave is the economic implications. I get emails now from a lot of my hedgy friends pretty much daily about rumours they're hearing about defaults and insolvencies, everything from bloody shipping companies through to kind of banks. And we're only seeing the penny drop on a lot of those kind of knock-on implications. And I think they're only working their way through the system now. And all that's happened is that investors have said, well, you know, the Fed will pick up the bill. Well, yeah, I mean, the Fed will pick up the bill. But ultimately, as even people like The Economist have been arguing, you do have to look at bank balance sheets and wonder about, you know, how much of a bill is this going to be? And then the second thing is, which I was always worrying about, and I still am worried about, is the emerging markets or developing world. You know, poor old Brazil is getting it in the neck. Next up is India. And this is, you know, terrible news on many, many levels. But look, just on a narrow level, unless the world intends to basically not fly anywhere between each country, we are all subject to the weakest link argument, which is that we may all think that we've conquered this nasty little bug, and we're in the clear. Well, we are in the clear until some other bastard decides to export it to us, or we import it, however you want to look at it. And we've already seen this happen. It's already happening in Australia. My son was over in Australia when the crisis was brewing up. And a couple of my Australian friends, he's better off being in Australia because he's really safe here. And for about a month, that's true. Until, of course, Melbourne broke out. And the Chinese are having the problem. South Korea are having the problem. We'll have the problem. I'm hearing rumours about the same out in Greece at the moment. And this thing ain't going away. Now, that doesn't mean you have to buy into the second wave argument that it's going to be massive numbers of people hitting a second wave in autumn, which may happen. But you still have to accept that either we're going to keep having these bouts, they are going to keep panicking people, and they're going to have a stock market reaction. So And I just don't see any way out of that, because we can't go into an autarkic world where none of us communicate with anybody. None of us, you have flights going, ships going, or people moving. That's just not possible for a period of time beyond 6 months. You could probably do it for 6 months, but after that, it didn't work. Even New Zealand's having this debate. You're doing a fantastic job in controlling it. And now there's quite a lot of people in New Zealand beginning to say, well, hang on, we can't just lock up for the next 2 years, 3 years, because that is what we are facing. It ain't going away, yeah? And look, the next man and woman would love there to be a vaccine, but I'm not holding out my hope for it anytime soon. And until we get it, we're stuck with it.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of how that sort of plays out in how you organise your own investments, I guess tying into what Gavin was saying at the beginning, that your badge is the adventurous investor, but that doesn't mean you're gung-ho. You talked about, you know, having stocks like Carnival and EasyJet and having that pocket of, you know, the shares that have been beaten up and you hope to rebound. I mean, like, how does it work? So that you mentally divide up your portfolio into bits that are meant to do different things.
Yeah, fundamentally, that's it. Yeah, you look at it in two dimensions. You either look at it in the tax wrapper dimension, which is, you know, you have your SIP and then you have various ISAs. Yeah. But and then look at it in another dimension is that I have, like, for instance, I've got an account with IG Markets stockbroking business for US equities. Yeah. And I think this year I'm plowing all my ISA money into US equities, probably foolishly based on everything I've said. And then I have another pocket where I do bounce back stuff, or I have another pocket where I do alternative stuff. And even within my ISA, I've got quite a lot of stuff which is really damn boring in one respect, but quite adventurous in another respect. What do I mean by that? It's kind of like alternative stuff, which really shouldn't go around the market too much, because it's, you know, it has different correlations to stuff. So I've got pockets of stuff that's still sitting in there, which hasn't really moved much at all in the last couple of years.
David, just Gavin here, just very interesting to get you talking. I just wonder, what is your split between direct equities and shares and funds, you know, collective schemes
I probably traditionally am about 80% funds, yeah, and about 10 to 20% equities, yeah. I'm probably a bit higher in equities at the moment because of the reason I said I've got some kind of targeted plays on things that I think are interesting. But I normally in funds, I'm not a very good stock picker. I just worked out a long, long time ago, particularly when I started writing many, many moons ago for the Investors Chronicle, which is a stock picking kind of place, that I was basically rubbish at it. Yeah. And I tried to do it methodically by doing stock screens. And so we set up the first stock screens under Matthew Vincent. This is a long, long time ago now. And we tried to do it methodically, and even then I wasn't very good at it. I've sort of not very good stock pick. But what I will do is I will pick stocks that I think are symptomatic of a bigger trend. So classic example is I don't think the whole music streaming thing is going away. I think it's a profound change. And so I've got shares in Spotify. You know, that's no great surprise. I mean, it's relentlessly overvalued in my view. But it is nevertheless... It is, if you want to play the music streaming revolution, it's a fantastic way of playing it, you know. And anybody who's got a Spotify account realizes how sticky it is, because, you know, as soon as you leave Spotify, all your playlists go, and it's a real pain in the ass. So I will pay individual stocks if I think they're part of a wider thematic trend.
That's Spotify is interesting. I'm just thinking about something you wrote recently, David, around constructing a defensive alternative income portfolio, and one of the listed investment companies you highlighted was Hipgnosis, so which is the music royalties fund, and which is very much also benefiting from the growth in streaming services like Spotify. Really interesting fund, I think you'll agree. But I'm just wanted to ask you what you think about, you know, the valuation of some of these defensive funds. I think Hipgnosis is on a 23% premium at the moment. I'm interested in your views on that particularly, but just more generally, some investment companies in alternative assets outside of equities, you know, they do trade at premiums quite often. And are you comfortable with that?
No, short answer. So I don't have Hipgnosis. I have no problem with Hipgnosis. I think, as for all the reasons that you and I have articulated, I think it's an interesting play. I think it is a bit overvalued, if I'm honest. I did look at it when it was about 90p, yeah, when a big sell-off, and I thought, oh, that's a bit overdone. And equally, you know, some of the renewables companies were busily trading down at 85. I can't remember, SDCL Energy Efficiency was trading down at 85, and it's got virtually no correlation to the stock market and economy. So, yeah, and a lot of that stuff has now bounced back and isn't trading at premium. So I am a bit cagey about it. So it's the same reason I've been very cagey about things like Primary Healthcare Properties, PHP, and Harry Hyman's business. I think it's a very good business. I have no problem with it. I just always thought it was appallingly overpriced, that's all. You know, good steady business. I'm not knocking it. I absolutely see it. I just think you can buy cheaper and better stuff, particularly in the kind of healthcare sector around, you know, social care properties like Target and Impact.
That's right. It's primary healthcare is on a 40% premium. I was looking at earlier on today, whereas you've highlighted Impact, which I think is 8% discount.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, look, I mean, PHP is a quality business. I'm really not knocking it. And again, same with Hipgnosis. Hipgnosis has got a lot of quality acts that or quality songs that it has the royalties to. I sometimes slightly worry. My view has always been with Hipgnosis that they buy stuff that even I've heard of. And if even I've heard of them, and I'm a crusty old, you know, grey-haired person, and if I've heard of these people, that means they must be really well known, yeah. And are you overpaying for it? I don't know. They say not, and I believe them when they say it because you know they know their business well. I just think they're a bit expensive. Whereas I think you can buy other stuff that has alternative characteristics. You've mentioned some that are better value.
And these income plays and the infrastructure income plays in particular, I guess they're taking the position that bonds would have normally taken in your portfolio.
I did have a few retail bonds. Actually, I do have one retail bond. I've got Premier Oil's retail bond, which basically it must be one of the few listed bonds that I think went below 50p in the pound or 50 quid in the pound. But that's a particular play I've always had, and I'm slightly ashamed I've got it because I'm quite anti-energy. But apart from that, I had a Places for People retail bond, which I've flogged off. No, I haven't got. You're absolutely right, Dan. I tend to have these kind of alternative buckets to provide alternative income. Yes.
David, I'm going to ask you about another investment trust, very well known, just which has a kind of capital preservation ethos, although maybe not as much as some, but I'm thinking of RIT Capital Partners, very well known investment trust invested by the Rothschild family, and was trading at quite a big premium at the end of last year, and has derated. And a couple of analysts have been, Stifel and Winterfloods, have been issuing positive notes lately because they're now on a discount. It's narrowed a bit, but I think it's about 4%. So we've been writing about that, those analysts' views. What's your view on RCP?
Yeah, I mean, RCP usually sits in the category alongside Rofer Investment Company, Personal Assets, Capital Gearing, Peter Spiller. So it sits in there. But the problem is each of those businesses and software funds I've just mentioned, they all have their own very unique characteristics. And RIT has its own very unique characteristics, which is you've got a very large private equity or private business component. And it's also invested in other funds as well. And that's not true of some of the other funds I've mentioned. Personal Assets is really quite more mainstream defensive equities. Peter Spiller does a combination of bonds and equities. Ruffer does, well, lots of things, including big put options. So they all have very different characteristics. I think if I had to choose between all of them, I wouldn't choose RIT, although I do think it's a quality play, yeah? And I don't deny its long-term strength. I'm a bit worried about the private equity exposure. I think that some of the wheels will come off the private equity explosion of the last few years. And I worry about RIT's exposure to private equity. So it wouldn't be top of my list. Whereas I think you can't deny, I mean, Rofer was trading at quite a big discount for a while. Actually, I haven't looked at it recently, but I imagine after that amazing put that they had on the market, option that they had on the falling market, they've probably done a bit better. So it wouldn't be. And actually, if I'm honest, where I've got my money is in Brevan Howard, their big hedge funds, listed hedge funds. Because frankly, if I am going to play an absolute return strategy, although to be fair, that's not what RIT is doing, it's more defensive. I would probably go with Brevan Howard at the moment, but we'll see, won't we?
Well, they've done incredibly well after some really dull couple of years. But there's two, they've done extraordinarily well from more volatile market conditions. Which one have you got? There's two. There's a global and a macro.
Both.
You've got both. Okay, right. Well, they've both done really well. Could you explain? Do you know what they actually do underneath the surface? All this sort of... All I know is they trade currencies and they trade bonds or credits. It's a bit more complicated than that, though, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is the great weakness of both of them. It's the great weakness of all hedge funds, is that they're black box methodologies. And their disclosure, whilst much better than it was, isn't brilliant yet. And they tell you which underlying sub-funds they invest in. So, Brevan Howard's main funds, you can sort of work them out. But you don't really quite know what goes on, what's the secret recipe. I suppose the reason why I think that fundamentally they're all a play on market volatility, yeah? And they're a play on macro direction, yeah? Because they are global macro funds. But they are basically a play on volatility. So if volatility shoots up, they tend to do fairly well. Although actually, if you want a slightly left field suggestion, if you want a cleaner play on volatility, why don't you just go, and I've mentioned this, why don't you just go and buy the spread betting firms? Because, frankly, if we all think that, we're going to hell in a handcart, spread bettors do remarkably well and have been doing remarkably well. So they have a cleaner link to volatility. But Brevan Howard basically is a play on market volatility, FX volatility, on political volatility, on credit volatility. And look, I know better than any of us do the problems of hedge funds, which is they haven't delivered on their goods, on their promise. I think that Brevan Howard, of all of them, probably has a fairly decent track record, and the money tends to suggest that they do that, play that game fairly well. There's always a chance that the wheels will come off their strategies, and that does happen regularly. But at the moment, from what I know about people who work there, the one thing I have heard is they are a phenomenal risk control firm. They are very careful about their risk management and allowing traders to get too far ahead of stuff, which is where it usually goes wrong. And they're very careful about managing risk.
That's really interesting. Dan, could I just come back on David and one more thing? It's moving onto a different sphere, really, but just picking up on your point about Brevan Howard's performance, it was a bit quiet, but there's a lot of respect for what they're doing. But that your mention of risk controls makes me think of Alexander Darwall and the experience that he's had at European Opportunities Trust.
With his Wirecard,
massive stake in Wirecard until it was clear that something very bad was going on, and he dumped the whole lot. But there's been, me and Dan discussed this at some length recently, and I was particularly downbeat or negative about the experience. But it's fair to say that there are analysts, one or two analysts, who are saying he's still a good fund manager. I'm wondering what's your view on fund managers that clearly their performance goes up and down. They can make mistakes. Would you give Alexander Darwall another chance?
If I'm honest, I don't know his strategy well enough, so I can't really comment massively on what he does. I think you just have to. It's horses for courses. You have to understand what you're getting yourself in for. So the reason you go for somebody like Brevan Howard, or frankly, you go for some of the other defensive funds as well, is because you know that effectively they're a play on volatility. They've got all sorts of rinky-dinky black boxes kicking around, but they're a play on vol. Then there are some and you want them when you're uncertain about the direction of a market. A market is sort of lacking a trend, or you think a trend is just too excessive, yeah? Then they have a value at that point. They're not the only investments that can do that, but they have a value. People like, the guy you've mentioned, and I mean, I sit on a board called Aurora, which has got a reasonably well-known manager called Gary Channon. They're a different beast. They're doing concentrated risk-on trades. Yeah, I don't think any of them would call themselves absolute returns investors. I'm sure Gary would like to say he produces an absolute return for his investors most years, but he just doesn't, because he has bad years and we have good years. What you're buying there is you're buying a very concentrated stock selection strategy, and you're playing the risk curve. Yeah, you're very happy to take risk, because when the markets are willing to reward you for risk, you'll get a disproportionately high return. And therefore, I don't have a particular problem with fund managers making a mistake. Where I have a problem with fund managers making a mistake, which may be relevant to the Wirecard thing, is where they take a disproportionate bet. And the risk controls basically mean that they bet the bank on something. You know, it gets to 20, 15, 20, 35% of the portfolio. That is deadly at that point, because even if you are playing the risk game, you then run a different risk, which is you've got the risk of markets, but then you've got idiosyncratic risk, which is just that the company you invest in is just a pile of poo-poo, yeah? You know, and that, unfortunately, when you run into successful businesses, there's always a chance that that amazing business that you think is absolutely fabulous, yeah, turns out actually to be rubbish, yeah, because they've not done something, yeah. And that's where the risk controls of a good investment trust really comes in, and people should turn around and go, well, the board should turn around and go, well, come on, we're staking the bank on Wirecard here. This is a dodgy bet, you know, should we just maybe, you know, notch it down to 10% or 7.5% or, you know, whatever percentage of the portfolio it is. So that, you know, that's where you have to look at the internal dynamics of the board and the concentration of holdings, really.
And David, I just wanted to pick up on your view on the UK stock market, really, because that was certainly an area that had been quite a strong feature of your columns for us, and obviously an area that has been has done badly following the Brexit vote, and then there was that sort of fleeting sign of redemption with the resounding election victory at the end of last year. Then some sort of signs of economic improvement, and then coronavirus has happened, and the UK once again has fallen to the bottom of the performance charts. My sense is that you still think that there is an opportunity there, but it's something that's now been delayed. When can the UK stock market start to do better, and what's going to trigger that?
Yeah, and also you have to be careful which stock market you're talking about. So if you're talking about the FTSE 250, it's a very different beast than the FTSE 100. So if we talk about the FTSE 250, which is the better domestic proxy for the UK economy, it's not a perfect proxy for the UK economy. It's not a bad one. Then, yes, I think it is delayed. And it's for the reason I said earlier, which is, unfortunately, we've had a rather bad experience with the coronavirus, and I think it's scarred a lot of consumers. Yeah. And that you can see that from the increasingly frenetic attempts by the Chancellor of the Exchequer to lure us into restaurants in August. Yeah. I think tells you that they've said it, you know, we are a services orientated economy, and people freaked out so much that our services aren't doing terrifically well, and a lot of them are shut down anyway. So unfortunately, through a combination of reasons, some of them ineptitude, some of them just bad luck, we've had a worse virus than other people have had, and that has had a knock-on effect on the economy, and it will have a knock-on effect on the economy. I do think, though, we will see a reassertion of the UK market's value. So if you chart the FTSE 250, if you chart the FTSE 100, sorry, against the S&P 500, I mean, there's a massive underperformance gap. It's not the same with the FTSE 250, and that's, you're not comparing like for like, really, because you're comparing a blue chip index in America with a mid cap index in the UK. The gap is much smaller. I do think the UK will do a bit better, but I think we're probably delayed now to 2021. And I worry in the UK that a lot of the companies that have done well in the FTSE 250 are now companies that have got flawed economic models, maybe moving forward. So that does slightly concern me. So I think it's delayed. I think, you know, we won't see the FTSE 250 push back until probably 2021. For the FTSE 100, it's slightly different because it's a very international global index. And unfortunately, until, for instance, the banks know what's going on with the banks, till we know what's going on with energy stocks, till we know what's going on with mining stocks, I'm afraid I think the FTSE 100 has got its structural headwinds that I don't really see clearing for another year or two, really.
And on the US and tech growth stocks in particular, I mean, a lot of investors will agree with you that is an area that has become overvalued. But I guess the issue with that is how you deal with that as an investor, because US and growth stocks are such a massive part of the market that you need to figure out your attitude. Is it, I'm just avoiding that completely, or I'm just trying to limit the size of that in my portfolio?
I think it's the latter. I think you can't ignore it. And there are some fantastic US tech names out there. You know, I mean, it's difficult to argue with Microsoft, for instance, you know, it's a fantastic business. So is Google. You know, they're good businesses. And, you know, to a more limited degree, Apple. So I think it's very difficult to ignore them long term. And I think if you don't have some exposure to US tech long term, I do think you're probably making a mistake. But I think you probably, what you have to do is you have to make sure that you've got diversified exposure, that maybe it's not 100% of your portfolio, it's maybe 35% of your portfolio or whatever it is. So I do think you need to think long and hard. And I think you need to be very selective about the tech names you invest in. Unless, of course, you're willing just to invest in the fund. You know, if you want to invest in, I don't know, Scottish Mortgage, or there's a couple of US tech sector ETFs you can invest in. I think iShares has got one, which are not a bad proxy, actually. They do a pretty good job. So let's take the fund route. But I think you need to be very careful, because I think there are some tech stocks out there. I mean, you know, we're not using it, but if we were to be using Zoom, you know, I mean, it's difficult to argue. As I've said with Tesla, it's difficult to argue those shares are fairly priced. But there are some other that, you know, you can see in the second division of stocks some really interesting tech stocks that are not absolutely insanely overvalued. But you just have to work a lot harder to get to them.
Well, and you've mentioned that with your ISA this year with IG, and you've said in your columns that it's after the first £30 of transaction charges, isn't it, that you get the rest for free. So you've become a frenetic trader.
Yeah, but honestly, I mean, I know that I'm a great believer in cutting costs for investors. And look, I mean, you know, I only found out about the IG one because I wrote about it. I mean, you know, I sort of actually had to ring them up and go, hang on, are you sure you're right? But, you know, you get the full range of the, I'm being honest, you get the full range of the US stock market. I'm not being paid anything by IG. You know, I've just got one of their accounts. And you get 30 quid and you then never have to pay for a trade ever again in your ISA. So why not? So you go trade like crazy. I have found myself overtrading. It's terrible. It's kind of like an Alcoholics Anonymous session. I have actually gone and put money in, and I found myself probably trading sort of 5, 6, 7 times a month. And actually, you have to trade 3 times a month to keep your free share trading. But I was looking at some numbers coming out of DriveWealth. And DriveWealth is a US tech platform that powers a lot of UK platforms like Freetrade and Revolut. And the average trades now are 6, 7 times a month in America. That's quite for UK investors investing in America. And I suppose I am probably the world's worst offender. I probably am doing about that. But that's only for a small portion of my portfolio. That's the kind of fun bucket and stuff that I just, you know, I mean, if it goes down, it goes down, you know, but it may well do really, really well. And actually, Spotify has done really, I've doubled my money in that. Carnival, I've doubled my money in that. I've got a couple of new things I've bought into, a company called Livingo, which a lot of the Bailey Gifford people like. So I've been dabbling around in it, making all of the bad mistakes that I've made before are probably going to repeat themselves.
Great. Well, David, thanks a lot for your time, unless, Gavin, you had any more questions.
No, that's a brilliant point at which to end, I think. I hope all that trading comes off. But thanks very much for your, you know, sharing us some of your insights and how you approach these things and your ups and downs. It's been very interesting. And, we'll look forward to your next column. And do come back and give us an update sometime.
Love to. All my great successes in American stocks.